Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform. Welcome to the show, guys. Today we're joined by Andrew Smith, who's one of the founding members of ClearBank and also one of the founding members of RTGS. We're going to get quite a bit of insight into your background in technology and what you do exactly at ClearBank and some of the reasons why you started RTGS and all sorts. But I think before we get into that, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks, Ben, for having me. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, you're welcome. I think we've got a good conversation ahead of us. I think, you know, to get us started, could you give us a bit of insight into your career history and your background in tech and how you came to working in technology?
Yeah, so off air, we had a bit of a bit of a chat about this, right? So as I said, it's one of those things that no one's really asked me in a podcast or anything, but and it's kind of interesting, people who have different backgrounds and how they get inspired to go into technology. And I think my background very much started with my dad when I was a kid, and he bought a Texas Instrument computer.
Right.
So I might be showing my age here a little bit. But, you know, played a couple of games on that, and then we moved to the BBC Model B. And, you know, he got me interested in trying to do some sort of computer programming, maybe code a little game and bits and bobs. It wasn't very good, but it was kind of like, that's where it kind of started. When you go on a little bit, you know, as you grow up and get a bit older, you want to play football, you want to do this, you want to do that. But I always kind of had this thing where I quite enjoyed technology or technology-based things. And it's very much driven by my father, as I said. Went to school and not very good at certain subjects. Yeah. Very good. Found computer science really interesting. So I had a great teacher there at Cooper. So my school was in Cooper's in Upminster, actually. And I had a great teacher there who's head of computer science, or was back then, Mr. Fordham. And he was really inspirational at trying to make you understand that, you know, what you're seeing in the computer now is what it can do today. But just think what it'll be doing in 5 years, what it'll be doing in 10 years. Think of the sort of software and engineering stuff you can come out of that. So that really inspired me to kind of work quite hard around what I thought was going to be something that I'd be interested in as I got older. But really, things in terms of career-wise took off when I left university. So I did a degree in computer science and then went straight into this really – I think it's quite astute, actually, or a bit lucky, but I went into a small IT consultancy company as opposed to a larger one. Mm. I think, you know, many graduates probably come out and they get job offers for, you know, Accenture consultant or whatever. But it was really interesting that I went for a smaller company, because I felt that in a smaller company you might get – exposed to the cold face a little bit earlier and a little bit sooner.
Yeah.
And I wasn't wrong, right? So within 18 days, I was up at Barclays in Uxford working on telephone banking. And that was kind of like where it all started. So it was either sink or swim, but it was really fun. I really enjoyed it. And I kind of got body shopped around a little bit. So I ended up falling into tech. I think earlier on we said some people fall into tech. I didn't fall into tech. What I fell into was the financial services sector. I had zero interest in it, but my first computing role was at Barclays. I think I went to NatWest and then RBS. I kind of spent a lot of time for probably the first 2 or 3 years in the financial services sector before a little bit of insurance and then telecommunications, and then deciding that maybe I should do this all on my own.
Yeah, great. I mean, we're going to get more into ClearBank and RTGS Global in a little bit, but I'm just interested in something that you said there, which was you decided to join a small IT company. I mean, there is a definite correlation these days with people joining startups early on, and because they have the opportunity to learn an insane amount very, very quickly. You know, if you're going to join one of the, you know, the big scale-ups or, you know, one of the tech giants, it'll take a lot longer.
Yeah. I think there's pros and cons of both, right? I think the big benefit of joining a startup or a small consultancy like I did is that you get thrown into the deep end very, very quickly.
Yeah.
So you'll learn a lot about the actual raw engineering side of it and how the whole solution comes together. You'll learn a lot more about the architecture of stuff. So you get not just this bit of, all right, I'm going to code around this particular area. You actually start to see a bigger picture earlier on. And the only thing I'd say that's a real positive about when you move into a bigger institution is that you get exposed to larger sort of methodologies.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And different ways of working and bigger architectures and that enterprise scale, you kind of fall into that. But as I said, I was lucky. It was a small consultancy, so we kind of had a bit of a startup mentality around some of the products that we brought to the customers that we had. So we would bring something like some paperless office, tiny solutions that kind of bolted onto bigger solutions. And right. then you got thrown into an RBS, so you got thrown into a Barclays, so you got exposed to the bigger project as well. And that was really why I think it was really, really lucky, really lucky. So if you're leaving university and you want to kind of really get better at coding, you should join a startup. If you want to get better at understanding kind of like macro projects, you need to join a bigger company. Personally, I would go smaller companies and then scale up or scale into projects to scale up. So you'll always have that real fundamental grounding of understanding what your engineering's like and working in a small close-knit team. It's a different experience.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. I want to talk about ClearBank now a little bit. So what is ClearBank in a nutshell and how do you fit into the world of technology?
ClearBank in a nutshell. So I'd say, first of all, actually, ClearBank's one of those grand ideas, right, that only comes around probably once in a lifetime. The concept behind it really was that it came from actually a guy called Nick Ogden, who's the founder of Worldpay as well. So I had met him on I had a tech startup and he had come on board as a non-exec kind of director role. But he had this vision and challenge that he'd seen with the banks, the smaller banks and fintechs and credit unions and all of those sorts of institutions that are smaller couldn't really compete with the big three or four banks at all. They just couldn't do it on a technologies face. They couldn't do it on the connectivity face or anything. And it also was one of those things that we realized that a lot of fintechs couldn't actually get up and running, a bit like my own fintech at the time was struggling or becoming stale because the underlying banking infrastructure just wasn't there. Mm. So ClearBank was really aimed at trying to say, okay, how can we deliver banking services to these other institutions that are regulated in a fashion that's modern, it's open, it's API driven, and it's really a toolkit to enable them to go and build out solutions off the back of that. And that was back in late 2014, early 2015. And we really termed it as banking as a service. So I think people know now what banking as a service means and the different flavors and variants of it. But back in late 2014, 2015, it was unheard of, right? So for us, it was actually, let's go and build this clearing bank. And no one's built a clearing bank in 250 years in the UK.
Wow.
Let's go and build it in the cloud. No one had ever built a clearing bank in the cloud. Let's go and connect it to all the main payment systems within the UK. And no one had ever chosen to do that silly feat and try and bring it to the market so that we could have a real infrastructural change in the marketplace to enable these fintechs to come aboard. And that's really what ClearBank's done. Yeah, it's been a challenge, but ClearBank right now has, I've left now, but it has probably over 100 and something odd regulated institutions that sit on top of that platform. They're taking advantage of business as a service infrastructure, and they're making change in the marketplace. If you look at companies like Tide has a real impact on business banking, and that sits on top of the ClearBank infrastructure. So that's the story, really, and that's where it sits in the tech world. Really, is probably a pioneer of banking as a service, and enabling institutions to have better access to better tech and better banking services.
Amazing. So when you first started this, when you first started ClearBank, you had a very modern way of looking at banking. And in the early days, was it difficult to get people's trust in the business? Because when it comes out that's new in this kind of area, people kind of just go, I just want to stick to what everybody knows, kind of thing.
It, trust is a weird thing, right? Because you start to get trusted once you get regulated. Yeah. But in order to get the regulator's trust, you need to go through the challenge that is becoming a regulated institution. And obviously we had a number of, they were kind of like bleeding edge technology or bleeding edge concepts. No one really had sat there and said, we were using cloud to build everything around a bank or a banking service, or definitely a clearing bank. So we had to take the regulators and the payment systems on a journey with us to earn their trust and to show them what we wanted to do. And I will be honest with you, that the regulators in the UK, the PRA, the FCA, and the payment systems themselves, Fast Payments, Backed and Chapped, they were absolutely brilliant, absolutely 100% supportive. We had some weird code names and project names between a lot of us, but they all came together, and it was the first time they'd all been brought together in the same room, and they kind of understood what we were trying to achieve. And that they didn't help us or give us any favors and stuff, but they were there to, just as they are with any new bank startup, really, to support you and take you on that journey to get regulated. Once we got regulated, you start to see that potential customers have trust in you, because if the regulators are taking you through this really rigorous process and they're trusting you and they've got that oversight, then you can start to trust the concept, you can start to trust the technology, you can start to trust the people behind that a lot more. So it's like anything with trust, really. It builds and builds and builds. But it was a challenge at the start, especially when, I mean, I won't say the meeting we were in, but Nick Ogden said we're gonna build a clearing bank in the cloud, and somebody in that meeting did lean back and look out the window and started scratching their head, and yeah, that was our response. A little bit of giggle as you thought, okay, we're gonna have to start with what is the cloud, and that was really where we did start on that journey. But yeah, it was fabulous being at the front of things. A lot of the concepts behind it have come from learnings over a number of years beforehand. I had a lot of learnings from a company that I'd set up, which was a mobile wallet payment infrastructure. That kind of gone stale a little bit because of access to infrastructure. So I knew the problems there and wanted to really drive that forward. And Nick had a whole host of concepts he'd had from Worldpay when he started that, but also a company called Cashflows and Voice Commerce. So you kind of merge all these ideas together, and it was very leading edge, yeah. And it still is, actually.
Yeah. I mean, so how many years ago did you start with ClearBank?
No, so the initial conversations between Nick and myself and the kind of like, let's start with a white piece of paper on what do we want to build and how do we build it? We literally, him and I, sat down with a white sheet of paper and sketched some stuff out, took it away. We played around with that from the back of 2014 through to sometime in mid-2015. And then it was from 2015 onwards that you have to try and get other people involved. So you can't just have two people. You have to have a whole founding team was put together. And that's Nick Ogden, really. He put together a founding team to take it on the journey. But it's 2015, you know, I'd say, is the real start of it all.
Yeah. So, like, obviously we know that tech these days moves just so, so quickly. Like, the new framework's been introduced all the time. Everything is moving incredibly fast. So with that in mind, would you say that if you were to build the business today, do you think it would be easier or more difficult or more challenging than back in 2015?
A hell of a lot easier.
Right.
And I'll give you a couple of reasons why. So the first one is the understanding of technology has changed. So as I just said, someone leant out the window and looked at the sky when we started mentioning the cloud. If you talk to the regulators, especially the regulators in the UK, the last kind of interactions I've had with them, they are probably more understanding of cloud technology than many of the financial institutions that they regulate now who are looking at cloud. So they do pick up knowledge very quickly and they apply it very quickly as well. So I think actually starting that journey now on a regulatory front would be considerably easier. The technical implementation would be different as well. That's because the cloud has, you know, the cloud itself is on a rapid journey, and it's got that Moore's laws thing going on very much so with the cloud. So the more and more services you've got in there, you know, we had a whole raft of services that we built as cloud native, but that technology that we built on has kind of been not decommissioned, but it's moved and evolved itself. You know, we had something called Service Fabric. You start moving off Service Fabric and going AKS. Do you want to use AKS or do you want to go to serverless functions? You know, there's a whole raft of things, or Lambda, for example, if you're on AWS. So there's a whole raft of different technology choices you can have, which makes it a lot easier. The deployment models will change. You know, we were very bleeding edge by having banking as a service, which is very much in line with SaaS offerings, software as a service. Mm-hmm. But right now, what we're doing with RTGS Global is not to go down that path, actually. We're looking at more things a little bit, let's call them pioneering. So they're more pioneering in terms of marketplace deployments, and you have managed services and managed applications that actually give you the connectivity and give you a whole raft of features and functionality, but you deploy it in your own infrastructure or in your own cloud infrastructure. So that SaaS offering starts becoming decoupled and decentralized. So that's the way that we've started to work with RTGS around that. And that gives you a lot more control over how you come across certain technical challenges like scale.
Yeah.
How do you scale that out? How do you assign cost to scale? How do you manage that? All of those sort of challenges becomes a lot easier. And it also means that actually you have a blast radius that's very contained. You know, if a bank goes offline and one of their connectors or containers, then it's just that bank. It hasn't taken down, you know, your SaaS offering hasn't potentially taken down one bank or many. You're only taken down that particular institution. So it's interesting that the technology's changed and the frameworks behind it have changed. So it would be a lot easier now, but I wouldn't go and create another bank.
Yeah. So let's delve into RTGS Global a little bit. Could you give us some insight onto that and what exactly it is?
Yeah, so the concept behind RTGS Global was really to solve financial friction across the globe, so global transactions. Again, this is a bit like the start of the ClearBank journey, was really actually what's the learnings that we've had, the frustrations that we've had, and can we identify how to fix them, really? So, and this one's been on the back burner for I think, primarily in Nick Ogden's mind for a very long time, right? So he had a lot of experiences when he set up Worldpay of the failings of cross-border transactions, cross-border payments, reconciliations, the frictions involved with that, the operational processes that you have to put in place to deal with all that. So I think it's one of those things that's always been bubbling there. When we built ClearBank, that we had a real insight into the underlying financial services infrastructure in the UK, but also how it works globally. And therefore, you get a real insight into the challenges and an understanding of why things are the way they are. And therefore, when you have that, you kind of have a new appreciation for the challenges that banks have had specifically around this problem. So RTGS, really, we looked at what is the real challenge. And at the end of the day, if you boil all things down and look at a macro level, it comes down to one simple factor, which is who's actually got the liquidity, the actual liquid cash that I need to facilitate these transactions. So RTGS is a liquidity network. I think some people think it's a payment system or it's some sort of cross-border payment infrastructure or fintech, but it's not really. RTGS Global is purely about the liquidity and a liquidity network. And as such, it brings together those who have the liquidity, collapses them into this really tight-knit community or tight-knit network, let's call it that, and allows the banks to access the liquidity that they need in real time. And off the back of that, you solve a whole raft of problems, right? So you get rid of the friction in terms of cross-border transactions, because if a bank can get hold of the liquidity it needs in real time, it can therefore facilitate an instant real-time payment across border. If you have the other challenges regarding things like credit risk of holding balances overseas, you've got things like Herstat risk, you've got all these risk and compliance pieces as well that all get bundled up that banks have to take on board and challenges there that us as customers are just hidden from. But when you look at something like RTGS, when you solve that with liquidity, you start solving a whole raft of these other challenges. So for us, we think, you know, it's a liquidity network, brings together banks. And off the back of that, we're aiming to solve a whole raft of challenges that banks face, which in turn then, you know, distributes those benefits out to you and I as end customers.
Wow, it's a lot to take in, Andrew. That's pretty amazing.
It's not a small challenge, right?
No, so exactly.
We like to do things in a bigger fashion. But it's something that's achievable, right? So we're now at a great stage with RTGS Global. We have a number of banks already engaged. They're either using our sandbox environment or they're starting to do their integrations into our platform, into the network itself. We've got some great consultancies around us and kind of like groups of people who are making sure that we articulate the proposition in a better fashion than what I probably have, to be honest with you. But it's all coming together. And when we did our proof of concepts, and I think we did a press release around this, we started moving real liquid cash between two jurisdictions. And, you know, we've got something called atomic settlement now. So if you were to atomically settle these liquidity, the swap of liquidity or the liquidity transfer, if you like, the beneficiary ownership, that's now sub 300 milliseconds.
Wow.
So to have sub 300 milliseconds based liquidity transfers means that you can facilitate an end-to-end transaction. So, you know, and if you want to pay somebody in Australia, instant.
That's crazy.
That's where we're going.
That's amazing.
But what's your expectation? So people say it's crazy, mate, but most people's expectation of tech is that it's instant. If I think of WhatsApp, I go on a WhatsApp message and send it, I expect it to be instantly to deliver to you. Why should a financial transaction, which is essentially messaging, be any different?
Oh, and that's
where we come from.
Yeah, you're so right. We've had a few people that work in this industry on the show, and they describe themselves as a tech business that does banking now rather than a banking business that does tech. Does that kind of make some sense?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. So I did a talk about 18 months ago, 19 months ago, and we were talking about fintech. So the fintech is a term for, you know, you've got a fintech bank like Modenzo, or you've got a fintech bank like Starling, or even like ClearBank. And my point was actually that's not an accurate description, because that's saying you're a finance company first, technology company second. And therefore, for me, the original fintechs were Barclays. They are Barclays. They're HSBC, they're Lloyds, they're RBS, they're NatWest. They're the original fintechs, because if we go back to as the start of this conversation, you know, my own career journey started with Barclays, or on a Barclays project. And it's a finance company first, and we were trying to provide those financial services via technology. You know, we were doing telephone banking. It was very leading edge at the time, trying to actually build those concepts out. But really, if you look at the new challenger banks, the culture really is slightly different. The culture behind it is not, I'm a finance company. It's just as somebody said in your earlier podcast, I'm a technology company that so happens to deal in providing financial services products. It's very different. And therefore, the way that you approach challenges is different. The way you embrace different technologies is different. The way you look to evolve or even cannibalize elements of your business is different, because you're cannibalizing it with new tech, knowing that actually that new tech will drive new financial products, new financial services.
I'd like to know a little bit about your, if you had any career reflection, just to get a little bit of insight into the man behind the business. what would you say is the biggest obstacle you've had to face to get to where you are today, either like technical or personal?
I don't know. Obstacles are quite hard to say, really, right? So yeah. I think the biggest technical obstacle we ever had was actually trying to start a company when you're already quite an established software engineer as an enterprise technical architect, and then deciding to move away from that and not go contracting, but actually say, right, I'm going to start a company. I'm going to work with a couple of friends, and we're going to try and build some product. We're going to become a tech company, right? That was actually a real obstacle mentally and technically to do. And it meant that you had to kind of understand more challenges around running companies or looking at companies in a different way. So that was a real big obstacle that kind of shaped a lot of the things that I've probably done since then. Another one is obviously, I think it's really weird, and I think a lot of software engineers have this problem actually, which is we enjoy software engineering, we enjoy the concepts behind it, we know how to communicate with each other in a very kind of not blunt fashion, but in a fashion that everyone gets across. And you have certain personalities that you get used to working with, so it means you don't like stepping out of that so much. And I think many software engineers don't decide to go on to become much more than this sounds a little bit stereotypical, but if you look at the raft of software engineers, how many of them actually want to go on to become an enterprise technical architect, or they want to step out of the actual engineering or the agile team that they're in to drive things more at an executive level? Not many want to do that. And the reason behind that, I think, is one, it removes you a lot more from the cold face of actually doing the engineering. But for me, it was actually working with different personalities.
Yeah.
You know, I think the biggest obstacle I've had is actually trying to understand that this is how you kind of talk with engineers, and you're familiar with that and you're really comfortable with that and you're understanding agile concepts and everything you want to do from a technology point of view, and the interactions that has, and then trying to move into different areas of, especially within financial services, to talk to the executive. I have big problems in trying to explain things. If I have to explain it more than twice, then I'm probably bad tempered after that. So maybe I'm my worst obstacle in some ways, but it does make it really hard from a personal level to try and take a lot of these concepts you want to talk about. Some people get it straight away instantly, and then you're talking to people who aren't so technical and trying to explain or iterate them through and take them on that journey. I think that is actually a really big obstacle that I've personally struggled with a bit, but then I would say I'm probably a lot better than a lot of my peers at it. So it's something that's really tough. And maybe it's a cultural thing where you start looking at businesses and say, actually, if we're tech focused, then more of the executive needs to be from a technology background. So it's tech first, finance second, rather than it's a whole raft of financial services executives with almost no exposure to technology. So it's, I think we're at that stage where it's, you know, there's a bit of a tussle, not a tussle, but there's a bit of a communications gap, an understandings gap, which over time will gradually ease as more people become aware of it. But from a personal point of view, that's one of the biggest obstacles I've always found, is trying to make sure you articulate the technology in a different way for different audiences. And then being patient enough to try and go over it more than twice.
Yeah, that's really important. And I didn't really consider that, because you would have to have, yeah, like you were saying, different conversations explaining essentially the same thing to different people. But I'm kind of thinking on the side of, you know, the customers. How do you convey to them exactly what you're doing, especially if you're doing something so cutting edge? Because they might not understand if you say, you know, we're doing this, this, and this. I mean, how do you?
It's really interesting, because customers don't come with many preconceptions.
Right.
They've just got. Well, this is kind of what I'm used to. Could it be better? They don't start telling you how it should be, or the constraints behind that. And as we've got more and more exposure to mobile phones, to tablets, technology devices, things like that, many more of us are customers themselves. So your customers, when they turn up, they're starting to say things like, I wanted to send a transaction to my cousin in Australia. I sent him a WhatsApp message and it was instant. Why am I waiting 7 days or 5 days or 3 days or even 25 minutes for my transaction to get over to Australia? It just feels wrong. So customers themselves start to, they're much more experience driven, as in the user experience, than the technology and underneath it. So actually selling them on an experience, or talking to them, conveying what the experience will be, they get it pretty quickly. They don't want to understand all the gubbins underneath it. Whereas you talk to the executive maybe, and sometimes they're like, well, actually, we want that friction there. We want these problems here. We want this, that, and that. Or, you know, it's not my time to really try and make that difference. So you get different personalities, different places. So I think customers are ultimately a lot easier to engage with. And it's interesting, because I think one of the points that we're going to talk about is like digital identity. And customers behind that is really, really curious, because customers are picking up on the concept of owning their own data more and more as we start to see more social media being, or social media usage. And then we're starting to see things like GDPR, and then, you know, that, what does that mean for the banks? And customers are becoming more and more astute gradually over time with, actually, I need to own this data rather than keep farming it out. And they'll be the drivers of things like digital ID.
I mean, this is a difficult question. It's about the industry as a whole, really. Have you noticed any industry trends that you think are playing wrong? I mean, you were just saying there with the data storage and things like that. Is there anything else that comes to mind?
It's hard to say things are plainly wrong. I think some of the things that are wrong is the mindsets behind things. So a lot of the time and it's not so much to say an institution, it's rather the individuals that then make up a team, that make up a group, that make up an issue. We all have our experiences and we all have our preconceptions of certain things. And I think what I mean, especially within financial services, is that you box yourself in to what you understand and what you know, and therefore what you can do in the future. So I think the biggest thing that's probably at fault within the financial services industry is having too much experience of what has gone before.
Right.
And because of that, we end up not really iteratively moving quickly. Financial services is actually quite a slow moving beast, partly because it has the regulatory oversight, partly because we want to make sure we protect people's monies, their mental health associated with money as well, and everything else. So that's actually a good thing. But when you get into the nuts and bolts of banking or financial services or the technology behind it, you find that most of the people say, well, we do it because of this, is this, or because it's always done like that. Mm. So then when you ask people to reimagine something, they almost reimagine the same wheel.
Yeah.
I think it's, I think this isn't actually a true quote, actually, but it's one of those kind of like legendary quotes that's not accurate, that Henry Ford had said, if I went out to my customers, they would have asked for a faster horse. And that's because they don't reimagine what is actually capable. And I think a lot of people suffer that, not just in financial services, but we all do as human beings, because we play on our experience, which is a good thing. But I think financial services needs to start embracing the fact that that is a problem. And it's something that's plainly wrong. And therefore, if you want to iterate and move forward, you need to get people in from outside of financial services with different experiences and different viewpoints, because they'll come at it in a completely entirely different way. They'll reimagine things that you've been doing or you think is right in new ways that then opens the doors to new experiences, better customer outcomes, better customer benefits, blah, 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 off the back of that. So I think that's the biggest thing that's wrong. The other... It's not wrong, but it's a bit of a failing of financial services and insurance and telecommunications, to a lesser degree telecommunications, is that they don't move quickly with technology. Technology is actually accelerating or further and further away from these businesses. So whilst if you look at technology in the 80s, 90s and early noughties, the banks were probably only like X amount behind it in terms of their adoption. You know, we'd probably see new tech come out every 2 years and they would try and look to adopt it and go through. But in the last 7-8 years, we've seen a real explosion in technology, predominantly driven by the cloud. And therefore, off the back of that, new things like big data, new concepts like, you know, machine learning or attentive machine learning, AI. You've got all of these concepts now are coming to the forefront. And you've got these digital experiences that are going up here, like this curve's getting exponential with the technology behind it and everything else. And financial institutions are still moving at the same pace. They haven't been able to pick up the pace to keep up with technology. So technology is moving away ever an ever increasing rapid speed of knots from the industry itself. And the challenge that's there is that you need to understand that you can't keep up. Banks have got this inherent mindset that I need to own everything that I do. I'm accountable for it, therefore I should own it. Accountability and actually owning it are very different things, or can be very different things. So I think what's wrong with the industry is that it hasn't really as yet understood that it's falling ever further behind. So it needs to jump on the back of these other technology providers who will provide you with aggregated services. If you look at cloud adoption, that's not really where it should be for financial services. I know there's a whole raft of challenge with that. You've got risk, you've got crime, you've got compliance, you've got all the other things that need to move there. You've got the legacy, you've got the success of what you've done in the past. But you need to then start looking and say, well, actually, I'm going to embrace something like banking as a service to make sure that that technology is getting rid of my legacy, and I'll build on top of that. So then I've got a better chance of keeping up with new tech as it comes out, because I'm partnering with other technology companies. I'm partnering and bringing things together, as opposed to trying to own it, build it, and deploy it all myself. So that's probably the biggest thing that's wrong. Those two things are probably the two biggest things that are wrong, I would say, within financial services.
Yeah, great. I mean, there's one point there that you mentioned earlier on, which was having diverse people on your team, or it was around that, in order to kind of stay forward thinking and in order to not like stagnate. I mean, we could literally talk about this topic we could literally talk all day about this, but I thought that was a really interesting point, and it's very... Yeah, it's the right way to think about things. Yeah,
diversity is what you need in terms of everything. I think obviously, if I say the word diversity to you, what's the first thing that pops into your mind?
Immediately, what I picture in my head is like a long table, like a meeting room filled with like people from all different walks of life. You know, that's what comes into my head first straight away. I don't know about what you would think.
No. So it's interesting. I always think of diversity primarily as cultural backgrounds, which is pretty much what you've just explained, right? But then if I actually think of it in terms of your mind background, it's actually your life experiences. And culturally, it gives you different life experiences, but also where you've worked, the types of areas of departments you've worked, the people you've worked with, the influences you've had behind it, that gives you a diversity of the mind as well. So I've always been really interested in saying or trying to approach anybody who wants to join a team that I'm working with or trying to build is actually to look at the diversity of their actual experiences of working within that industry or outside of that industry, and often who the people they've worked with or their influences. it becomes quite interesting because you start to see that people bring with them different skill sets, different talents and different experiences. And then you can not put together people like a jigsaw puzzle, but you can actually start to bring in these different, you know, backgrounds and thought processes and way of approaching problems. And, you know, problem A is best for suited for person A, B and C, and problem B is better for D, E and F. And you can start seeing these things really, really mature. And it's really interesting. It keeps you fresh as well. And it when I looked at, sorry to bore you for 2 seconds, when we were building ClearBank, we had a blank sheet of paper for everything. So when we looked at a lot of these operational processes, or especially around governance and financial crime and things like that, you know, the first thing was really interesting, the people that joined the bank came with their experiences that they had. And we run these workshops. But we soon realized that by running these workshops, we were getting the same outcome as what the banks had already pretty much had, but just slightly more autonomous or automated or better tech behind it. And really what I'm saying is actually, well, I want to get some of the engineers in here and I want somebody from a different experience over there. This guy worked with cards. That one worked in risk. That one works in operations. These are 2 engineers. Here's someone who works building a go-kart. You know, it's weird. Bring them all into the room. And all of a sudden we had very different views of processes. So stuff that started was a bit more business process management. Point A goes to point B. Do you do this? All of a sudden we realized you can collapse those. And if you did this, you could do that. And all those processes become a lot shorter, very, very different in their approach, but still had the same regulatory oversight, the compliance, the robustness behind them. That still happened because you have people in the room who are challenging the thought process behind it, who came from a background who understood what that would mean in terms of, you know, comply. So that was the best way of doing that. And it was all because you have diversity of cultures, but diversity of mind, diversity of thinking.
Yeah, that's incredibly interesting. It really is. Yeah, great words of advice as well. I was speaking to someone the other day who is a DE&I manager for a firm, and he was saying that if he notices that a company are rehiring like the same people and they're ending up with like the same backgrounds, he was saying he challenges the recruiters to look at the last 5 hires or so and then note down kind of their experiences, and then he challenges them to find someone completely different.
Yep.
Which I thought was completely pretty interesting. Agree. Yeah.
Completely agree.
Yeah.
I think recruiters have a tough job because
absolutely
they've got to try and get into the businesses themselves.
Yeah.
And many businesses, especially regulated institutions, will have screaming children in the background. We'll have supply chains and things like that and how they actually manage those. So they'll have approved supplier lists. You've got to get on that approved supplier list, which is not always the easiest thing to do.
Yeah.
But the best way I always think of impressing somebody who's building teams or trying to bring people together is to show that actually, look, I'm going to present you with 5 candidates and, you know, 2 of them may have the perfect experience that you've been asking for.
Yeah.
And 2 of them, they've got very different experiences, but quite clearly they can show you the same principles behind what you're looking for. And then 1 of them over here is completely and utterly random. And as long as you don't just present me those 5 people,
yeah,
because I'll sit there and go, that one's random, these 2 aren't really what we're doing, and that's the 2 experience. You've only sent me 2 out of 5. But that's what I think a lot of people who are looking at recruiters will probably turn around and say. But actually, if you as a recruiter can turn around and say, actually, no, I've sent you these 2 because we believe they'll give you the experience of thought that you're looking for. Let's say it's in financial services because they have X number of years working with, I don't know, banks and payment systems, and they've done this with fast payments. Great. If I'm looking for somebody to drop into my fast payments team, that might be perfect. But the other 2 over here, well, they haven't. They've been working on WhatsApp or Telegram or, you know, they're very used to this world of scaling up and instant messaging and understanding billions upon billions of messaging. I might actually sit and go, well, that person might be really interesting to drop into my FPS team because as I scale FPS, essentially it's still messages, right? So I've already got the skill set there that understands the technology behind the faster payment systems, the rules and the business models around it. Why wouldn't I look at somebody over there who has been building like Telegram or WhatsApp or whatever? And then the random one on the far right, if you can explain why you think they potentially could have value, all of a sudden you have a rich vein coming from your recruiter that actually you think, no, that's really good. You're challenging my mindset with the diversity thinking about the people who may get placed. And if you can give me that, then all of a sudden I'm able to build diverse teams that are still relevant, still principle focused, and still going to they're going to actually innovate far better. So that's the biggest challenge, I think, for recruiters, is how do they actually deliver that sort of experience to people like myself who look to hire engineers?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly important, isn't it? I mean, and especially in technology, I think people are really starting to notice the difference that a diverse team can make, which is amazing to see. And I mean, a lot of the guests I have on, always, all of them have like a similar mindset on that. So it is amazing to see. Well, I'll tell you what, I've got one more question that I'd like to ask, if that's all right. So what's underestimated in the industry, would you say?
What's underestimated?
Yeah.
I think what's underestimated is the adoption of new technologies, new concepts. And I think that's partly why we see challenger banks being able to deliver new experiences and why they onboard so many people.
Right.
I think it's an underestimation because I think there's an inherent mindset that we own customers. Yeah. So if I'm whatever a bank, I own those customers. I own their data. I own their account. And actually, you don't. The customer owns their account. It may be sitting on your system. You may provide that service to them. They own their own data. So I think what is often underestimated is the customer's ability to, when incentivized enough, to actually up sticks and move. I think one of the big success stories, obviously, was Monzo and Starling in the last 4 or 5 years in terms of challenger banking. And their experiences, if we look at their product, like for like, right, why would I move from an incumbent bank? The reason I've moved is actually because it's more customer friendly and more customer centric and actually falls in line with my own expectations. And those customers are moving because there's been an underestimation by the incumbents who held their accounts originally that thought they're going to put up with a service that's not quite immediate or is not quite as transparent or is not quite as flamboyant in some ways than the other two. So I move ship to go and get a better customer experience or an experience that's more in line with my expectations. We touched on digital identity. I think that's actually going to be a real driver because you'll start to see more people embracing this privacy around self-sovereign identity. They'll start using it for other services and stuff. And then before long, that then feeds back into other aspects of their expectations of life. Just as WhatsApp and the instant message gratification, if I can go to a dating website, not that saying I need, I'm married, but I didn't meet my wife on a dating website. But if you go to a dating website and all of a sudden you say, actually, I don't need to fill in a profile. I'm just going to share certain things, or I might want to change my name or give some sort of anonymity there. But at least there's a verification that I am this age range and I am who I say I am, essentially. The net experience of signing up is considerably quicker, but actually the other side of it means that I've actually got verification. The people I'm meeting are the people who say I'm meeting, I didn't sign up to meet a 35-year-old lady and she turned out to be 55. You don't have any of those problems,
yeah.
But so if you have that there and it starts moving around into different areas of the value of the internet or the internet of value, then before long, you have to have things like insurance. You have to have things like telecoms. You have to have financial services that wake up and say, our customers are expecting this. And if they don't, there'll be a Monzo or there'll be a Starling or there'll be a Tide or somebody else who will actually now embrace it. And therefore, they will grab a whole raft of those customers and the value behind those customers simply because they've embraced something that is an expectation of a customer going forward.
Yeah. This is a slightly kind of left field question, but I mean, would you say that the big banks, is there any part of them that's like maybe a little bit fearful of startups that are really shaking things up in the banking world?
So I don't think they're fearful because I think they're very aware that actually things have been shaken up. So if you look at what the larger incumbent banks have been doing, they've been actually making sure you have similar experiences. My own banking app is now pretty much sending me the same sort of real-time notifications as what I get when I'm using Monzo and Starling. So they're definitely caught up, and they're copying his expectations. So they're obviously aware. They're obviously not. I wouldn't say fearful is the right word for it. Mindful, maybe the right word.
Yeah.
Mindful that they need to do something around that. So they've been mindful. They've actually caught up and they've delivered things. If you look at some of them, they've started to hire people from these challenger banks. There's a girl called Megan Hayward who's moved from Starling and went to Barclays.
Right.
You know, so there are people who are migrating from these challengers into what you might call as a more encumbered large bank. And they're actually having a real influence on the expectations and experience that are coming out of that. So I think they're very mindful of what the risk is there. The other challenge I think you have, especially within regulated businesses, is how long people sit in seat. How long does your executive, like your COO or the CEO, actually stay there?
Absolutely.
Or the CFO? And because of that, you get this, well, actually, if the investment's not going to move the needle for me in the next 2 to 3 years, I'm probably not going to be here. I want to move on to my next challenge, or I want to retire, or whatever I want to do. So because it doesn't move the needle in such a short period of time, it's almost like you push it down the road for my successors to deal with. And because of that, I think that fearfulness or the mindfulness is sometimes lost a little bit, and therefore things – You can see bigger institutions being caught out by a move, because actually it's literally to do with the people who are saying, I'm going to leave that for my successor because it's not going to move the needle for me right now. I want to make a name for myself or do whatever. And therefore they don't do it. So I'm very conscious that, a bit like elections, everything goes in these little cycles of 3 to 4 years. So you need to make sure you can prove an ROI within that period of time. If you can't, It would take long. So big technology moves, like I want to shift all of our core banking to the cloud, that's not an 18-month job. And because of that, you see that people not shirk it, but they actually look to avoid or put off that particular decision, no matter what the cost or implication could be 5-6 years down the line. Mm.
God, Andrew, we really could chat all day. I mean, we really are putting the world to rights with this in this topic. But I've really enjoyed our conversation. And thanks so much for being so open with your answers. I'm sure a lot of people are going to get a lot back from this. So I really do appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. Nice being here.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform.